Well, this has been quite a week. We've had in the news this week, Vermont has passed the first civil union law. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard the case of the Boy Scouts, whether they have to admit homosexuals to their organization. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court heard arguments about partial birth abortion. And yesterday, there was a Senate hearing on embryonic stem cell research. And it's only Thursday. You know, we never lack for things to discuss. Actually, we were in motion for these topics, and I've given the handout. I put together this handout to sort of help us through some of the respect for life issues. So keep that at your elbow, and I'll deal with it. I'll work our way through that. It'll expedite. But we obviously need to pray. Lord, we need you every hour, but especially in our day and at this present time, we need your wisdom and strength, the power of your Holy Spirit to enable us to be discerning and courageous in our stand for the convictions that derive from your word. Be with us as we sort through these high-profile current issues that we may be able to minister in our generation. Guide us into your truth, we pray, for Jesus' sake. Now, I promised to say something about humanitarian intervention in connection with what we were doing about the just war, and I'll have a few words to say about that. But I was asked earlier to comment on the Elian Gonzalez case, which I did, and there's been a development that I think I need to comment further on. The SWAT team operation, I think, requires to be defended as just and necessary. I was deeply disturbed at that raid, as you might imagine. This is unprecedented in this kind of a case, so I think that it needs to be sorted out. And as I've been thinking about how to sort it out, how to require the administration to explain why it was both just and necessary, it seems to me for paramilitary operation, you really need these criteria to be applied. So if you just think with me for a minute about the question of legitimate authority. This has been raised as to whether the Attorney General had the authority to send in the SWAT team on her own decision. And she has the authority over INS to make the decision to do that, which was resisted by the people who were had been originally given custody of Elian. And so there's an administrative order that she has the right to make. But it's been questioned constitutionally by a very important constitutional scholar. Lawrence Tribe at Harvard had a piece in the New York Times, and he brought that into question as to whether that is within the authority of the INS to conduct this kind of a raid without a court order given the situation. So I think that needs to be sorted out. Did it require a court order, or is that something that can the INS can do on its own? It's a good question. The Wall Street Journal, I haven't seen it, but there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday which challenged the idea of the legitimacy of the search warrant under the situation while the case is still pending in court. So it needs to be aired as to what the authority is for this kind of operation. Now, SWAT team operation is not exactly the same as just cause for going to war. Going to war, you expect to use weapons, and the administration has laid great stress on that this was a show of force and distinct from use of force. The rules of engagement are different. You can only use force, deadly force, as a matter of necessary defense. And the ground for using the force that was used was that there was intelligence that there were weapons, and they wanted to be able to protect the men going in and so forth. But your rules of engagement are only to shoot when there is life at stake. And so that's justification for the arm. But the administration also said that it was the show of force. When you go in with a strong show of force, you eliminate not only the weapons, but you intimidate. And I think that we should recognize that that is a use of force. Okay, it's not actual shooting, which is what they meant by use of force. There are rules of engagement where that couldn't be done, except in defense of life. There was the possibility, it's argued, of that being a response. But I think that this is the bothersome part. Force was used, the show of force was intentionally to intimidate so that there wouldn't be no wrestling match or anything, but rather there. Now, I think that does the cause. Remember, just cause means what would justify the degree of force that you expect to use when you go to war. And I would say the degree of force that's used in this situation, and you need to sort through whether the restoration of a child, of parental rights, paternal rights in this case, justified a SWAT team. The argument is that the child was in an abusive situation. That was prepared for by the release of a letter of a pediatrician. Turns out it's an administration insider. Shaping of public opinion through the release of that pediatrician's recommendation of a rescue operation is what built up to what was a SWAT team that was done for the purpose of a rescue operation. Well, you know, the way the authority under which it's done, along with the purpose for which it's done, I'm not going to judge intentions. The ostensible intention, the stated intention, is to restore the boy to his father, to remove him from the custody that had been given to those parents, which they refused voluntarily to relinquish in order to bring him to his father. And whether there's more to it than that is a matter to be looked into, but I'm not able to judge intent. But that is the stated intent. And if there's more to it, then that's a difficulty. Probable success, well, I think going in, there was a great deal of, there was some risk, but it was probably a success. I think it meets that criterion, though it took a risk. But I think that you have to realize that the probability of success is in inverse proportion to the intelligence about the weapons that were there. It was high degree of success because of very little evidence that they would meet the kind of firepower that they were bringing to bear on it. But my main concern is whether it was actually necessary, whether it was, in fact, last resort. Now, if it was, it's a sad, sad commentary on our state of being able to negotiate and persuade people to do what's right. I think it needs to be looked into because the reports that we get are that those who were involved in the negotiating process felt the family had moved and was moving, and that you really had a kind of administrative, preemptive intervention in order that they claimed was necessary, it seems to me it is questionable that it was a last resort. You can see the element of surprise and going in and all of that, but it's a very disturbing thing for this kind of an operation, a SWAT operation, to take place in this kind of a circumstance. And I think that we should not be naive about the administrative's power to shape public opinion. And public opinion is overwhelming in support of this raid, and because they see smiling pictures and they hear psychologists that say Elian is fine, but there's no independent looking at that. So I think congressional hearings are appropriate for such a dramatic operation that's unprecedented in our history. I hope it will not degenerate into posturing on the one side and stonewalling on the other. That's been so often the case with congressional hearings. But it seems to me it's a serious domestic use of force that needs to be looked into for those reasons. And these issues are, it has been interesting to me since we just went over this, that these issues are all being raised. It's the same kind of thinking that goes into to this area. Now, there are lots of questions, but I'm going to have to move on because we've got a lot else to do, and we can come back to it, or if you want to see me and talk further, that's fine. But I know you all have perspectives and all have questions. I wanted simply to, for the purpose of this class, I felt obligated to say something about my take on it, but also the viability of looking at just and necessary in terms of the criteria that have been long established. It's a good way. Now, when it comes to humanitarian intervention, which was the point that we were at last time, whether that is just cause, whether that fits under the category of just cause, this is the question of the 1990s, especially in light of what's happened in Somalia, in which that was a success. I think that there may have been some overreaching. It resulted in some of our soldiers being killed and paraded around, and that led to immediate withdrawal. That set the stage for non-intervention in Bosnia till very late, and withdrawal from Rwanda, and it was the background for the final intervention in Kosovo. So this is the question of the 1990s, how to enforce the body of law, the body of international law, that includes genocide, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing. You know, how those are all principles of international law. The question is, how do we enforce them? And this is where just war thinking is at the present time. Beginning with Bosnia, Pope John Paul II did define as a just cause legitimate use of force and the duty to intervene when whole populations are put at risk. And that duty falls generally to the international community, but in the last resort to whatever powers are capable of taking action. You know, it is a concern, but an ill-defined area in international law. This now needs to be sorted out. How do we enforce these principles? It was thought after the Second World War that only defensive war against a person's own territory or those with whom you are allied was justifiable war. Now, with these events, these stupendous events, these tragic events, we seem to go back to what is an earlier principle in just war theory, and that is offensive war is sometimes just and necessary. It goes under the label humanitarian intervention, but let's not lose sight of the fact that it's a matter of justice that you intervene on the part of people who are being persecuted, cleansed, killed in masses, and so forth. Now, I think that there are at least three things that need to be thought through in connection with this. And the rethinking of this has only just begun. But I think that it's clear that there needs to be a reform of international law to accommodate this insight that military force may be used for so-called humanitarian intervention. It's unclear in international law. Secondly, I think that we need to think through this side of the just war picture, discrimination and proportionality, there is to bring a better balance than we had in Kosovo on the vulnerability of innocent noncombatants to our military strategies that are now so risk-averse. You know, the argument against Kosovo and the argument against sending ground troops is the American public wouldn't stand for it. And so you have those extremely high bombing raids that caused a lot of civilian death. You know, I think that that needs to be revisited to do that. And I think that there is a third area that's being talked about, is the restoration of military honor. I don't know quite how to take this, but the idea is, the premise is, that military personnel can actively bear arms because they're willing to die in defense of the innocent. That is something of military honor that you take on yourself. And when we take extreme measures that risk civilian life in order to protect the lives of soldiers. Now, I don't want to put soldiers in unnecessary danger, but there is a risk that may be necessary in order to fulfill the conditions of what is just in the conduct of warfare. So I think that, you know, we have developed, and I think a fourth area, let me say something about a fourth area, is diplomatic strategies need to be revisited. I think that in the early part of this century, they developed the term gunboat diplomacy. Well, I think that we now have smart bomb diplomacy. We know that we can bomb somebody back into the Stone Age without getting hurt. You know, that affects the way we go into these negotiating situations. I think that needs to be looked at again, an emphasis on nonviolent means of settling disputes that arise in these humanitarian concerns. Well, there's a lot more, obviously, to say on that. But I want to move to the issues that we constantly face in terms of respect for human life. It's a two-parter today and next time. Respect for human life at the beginning, respecting human life from beginning to end is the overall heading. But put it this way, well, respect for human life at the beginning, we'll deal with today. And there are six sub-points under this heading. First of these is to be clear about the biological facts of life. And I have given you on the first page of the handout, Significant Events in a New Life. I'm mainly concerned about the chronology of the new human life. It's coordinated with the chronology of the human mother. It was out of sync in this, whoever did this, and so I've drawn lines to connect the two chronologies in terms of their time. And I've entered in my own hand when abortions are done, 11% before 6 weeks, 80% between 6 and 11 weeks, and so forth. And at the bottom of the second column on chronology of new human life, I have noted that at 20 weeks, there's 10% survival probability ex utero, that is outside the womb. That increases to 57% at 25 weeks. So, and after that, it is grows accordingly. But that's our basic material that we need to know. I'll comment further on that. The life of every human being begins at conception. Conception is the fusion of sperm and egg. You know that every cell in the human body has 46 chromosomes except the gametes, the sperm and the egg, each having 23. And at fertilization, they unite to produce a one-celled human being. 46 chromosomes. Now, that doesn't happen in a moment, in the blink of an eye. It takes between 26 and 30 hours to happen. But basically, at the end of that first day, you have a new organism that has a distinct genotype, never be repeated. We know that the life of every human being begins at conception as a distinct, with a distinct blueprint that unfolds throughout. The next event that I think it's worth remarking on is implantation. This is between 6 and 10 days. So it works its way down the fallopian tubes in natural implantation to implant in the womb. I suppose you could say that a woman is pregnant when the embryo implants itself in the wall of the womb, but she's a little bit pregnant in those days before that. And, you know, there is a being, an organism, a new organism that is on its way. And I think that the practical effect of this is you need to take a look at so-called contraceptive devices that actually prevent implantation because they are preventing an organism from implanting in the womb, preventing pregnancy, but not conception. There is some confusion about that. They don't prevent conception. They the IUD, for example, works by preventing implantation. The next point is what is called individuation, which is happens on about the 14th day. Individuation is when something happens that if they're going to be twins, that's the point at which it's clear that they're going to be twins. It's an irreversible point. Before that time, there may be some confusion as to whether there's going to be twins or not. Sometimes it appears that they're going to be twins, but the two parts recombine, and so there's only one individual. But it's called individuation, and it's documented at the 14th day that occurs. Now, in Great Britain, they have decided that experimentation up to the 14th day is permissible. They call these pre-embryos. Up to the 14th day, these are pre-embryos. And it's based on this idea of individuation. That was started out in America as well, but that's been abandoned in America. These are embryos from day one. A new organism comes into being at conception. And this is all unfolding. Part of it unfolds into the placenta, but the being, the human being, is there from day one. You implants between 6 to 10 days. Not all are implanted, but don't be misled by the statistics on that. It's not clear why so many, it's said to be as many as half, are never implanted. Those may be incomplete conceptions or something gone wrong in the conception process. The truth is we don't know the status of those that are never implanted. But what we do know, what can be stated with certainty, is the life of every human being begins at conception. Individuation occurs at the 14th day. And from then on, the next event, the next decisive event, is birth, which, as you know, is roughly 9 months. If you look at there is one point that I want to highlight, and that is, it's number 14 on the chronology of the new human life. The name at 56 days, that would be 8 weeks. At 56 days, all organs are functioning, stomach, liver, kidney, brain, all systems intact. And all future development of new life is simply that of refinement, increase in size. The name is changed from embryo to fetus at that time because of the clear human formation that you have as a child in the womb from fifth to sixth day, from eight weeks. You notice, by far, most abortions take place after that point, after you have a fully formed and functioning human being in the womb. I don't think it's right to infer that we should protect the life of the fetus and not the life of the embryo, because it's a continuum. It's a developing continuum of an organism through that. Now, these facts are well documented, even physically photographed, and a child is born. Dr. Winter's book on abortion includes, he got permission to include photographs from that book, and they've been used. And the material keeps growing. There's that, they operated on a spina bifida baby in the womb. Remember that photograph as the doctor removes and reaches up his hand and grabs the doctor's finger? It's very emotional. You know, I can hardly talk about it. But that's what's in the womb. That's what is in the womb. Now, B, for a biblical perspective, this is in your reader under the PCA report, so that it is, I don't feel a need to go into the biblical perspective in detail. If you want, you should read that for the details. But it's clear that God is active in the process of procreation. The mandate is Genesis 1:28, and the God-ordained means of populating the earth with human beings in His image is the generative potency of human sexuality. Human beings are not merely reproduced after their kind. The language is different. Human beings procreate beings who, like themselves, are the image of God. Check out Genesis 5:1-3 and think through the implications of what it says there about begetting a child in His image. And the Bible frequently acknowledges that conception is a matter of God's gift, an event that occurs under His providence. The story of Hannah is a good reminder of this truth. Other examples abound. The truth is enshrined in the praises of Israel, Psalm 127:3. Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is His reward. Now, in Scripture, for example, Isaiah 7:14, the Bible regularly links the events of conception and birth. The virgin shall conceive and bear a child. Now, that's typical biblical language. They don't know all about implantation and individuation and the rest of this, but they know that there is a beginning and that it results in a birth. Between those two events, God continues His activity in the unfolding development of the child in the womb. And we know from Psalm 139, verses 13 to 16, that unborn individuals are the objects of God's continuous attention. Thou didst form my inward parts, Thou didst weave me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. When I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth, figurative for the womb, Thine eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in Thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me. And what King David finds so overwhelming in this psalm is the Lord's all-encompassing personal knowledge and presence. So he's there from the beginning. That's David in the womb. And also relevant is the historical beginning of the incarnation, whereby the Son of God took to Himself human nature, being conceived by the power of the Holy Spirit in the womb of the Virgin Mary. The uniqueness of that event, its miraculous mode, does not affect the relevance. From conception, however that event happened, the Son of God is incarnate. And his human nature, the Son of God in human nature has the right to life by no other law than that which grants it to every human being. Jesus, as to his humanity, was made like us in every way. So the biblical data is clear. Exodus 21, verses 22 and 23 is thought to play down or make a strong difference between the unformed or the child in the womb and the mother. But it is possible that this is not a miscarriage that's brought on, not a spontaneous abortion that's brought on, but a delivery brought on by trauma. If you want to take a thorough look at that text, there is an article by Meredith Klein in the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, Volume 20. That's 1977. You should be aware of that article, but I'm not going to require you to read it for this. But it does review that text and shows that there are a number of exegetical possibilities. It would be hazardous to develop a right to take human life on the basis of that text. It's by Meredith Klein, and it's in the Journal of the ETS, in Volume 20, which is 1977, pages 193 to 201. And if you're interested in a full bibliography on abortion, email me and I can distribute it to you. The next question, given the biological facts and the biblical perspective, what should we think of the morality of abortion? Now, I think that the issue should be framed this way. The moral issue in abortion is whether the life of the fetus, sometimes we use the fetus for the whole, we don't pay attention to from the eighth week only, but we refer to fetus from conception to birth. I think that's appropriate. The moral issue in abortion is whether the life of the fetus is to be preserved just as the life of every human being. I guess we would have to say just as the life of any born human being, or whether as a developing human being, the life of the fetus may be taken away in circumstances that would not otherwise justify the willful taking of human life. Moral issue in abortion is whether the life of the fetus is to be preserved just as the life of any human being after birth, or whether as a developing human being, the life of the fetus may be taken away in circumstances that would not otherwise justify the willful taking of human life. In other words, to put it another way, are the unborn included in the respect and protection we are morally bound to accord to human life? Well, I think in light of the biological facts, leaving aside for the moment the biblical perspective, which I think gives to us a further motivation as we understand how God works in the womb, but at a minimum, the significance of the biological data in reference to the morality of abortion is to establish the burden of proof. Now, pro-life people don't have the burden of proof. Pro-choice people have the burden of proof. Since abortion is an act of human initiative, which interrupts this continuum of developing human life, the burden of moral justification rests upon those who defend the morality of abortion. My point is this. If human life is held at some point to be inviolate, but not from conception, when a new biological organism comes into being, then the burden of proof is on those who would inflict death to show that the point in which you may inflict death is not arbitrary, but is grounded on something in reality. Now, I think as we get into this, the most common case now has been for a while, but it's become more and more prominent. The most common argument for some protection of fetal life, but not full protection, not as any human being, is the potential person argument that justifies taking the life in the womb, though it doesn't justify taking of life of actual persons. A number of evangelicals have taken this view. Arthur Holmes of Wheaton College, now retired, in his book on ethics, don't try to get this down, but listen to what he says. Biologically, any human fetus is, of course, human life. That is widely acknowledged now. It didn't used to be, but it is acknowledged now. Even Naomi Wolf, in a famous article in the National Review, or the New Republic, made that argument. She's a prominent feminist. Most recently achieved notoriety by being Al Gore's consultant on being an alpha male. Holmes writes, biologically, any human fetus is, of course, human life, and even though it is not yet an actual person in the sense of a self-conscious and reflective being relating meaningfully to others, it is a potential person, likely to develop all the powers that adults have. As such, its life is to be received and protected as a gift from God. So abortion on demand for personal convenience as a means of birth control fails to recognize this, but that is not to say that an early fetus as a potential person shares full human rights equally with actual persons. So exceptions, there are exceptions to this. Now, I think that this argument has become very common, making a distinction between human life, which is undeniable, and personal life. The problem is, on these criteria, self-consciousness, reflection, meaningfully relating to others, infants can be taken away. As a matter of fact, that is Peter Singer's argument. He's been arguing this for some years. He published a book in 1985. He mentioned the case of a child named John Pearson, born June 28, 1980, with Down syndrome, and died of neglect July 1st, 1980, 3 days. Because he was a Down syndrome baby, his parents refused to let him be fed. And so he was made comfortable, but he died of neglect. Why does Peter Singer believe that In the case, Peter Singer goes beyond allowing the child to die. That's, in a way, cruel. It's more compassionate to kill the child. Why does Peter Singer believe, in such a case as this, infanticide, that killing a newborn human baby is ethically justified? Well, there are two main reasons. Such an infant is not a person. Infants are sentient beings, that is, they can feel pain, so you have to painlessly kill them. But infants are sentient beings, this is a quote, infants are sentient beings who are neither rational nor self-conscious. Their species is not relevant to their moral status. I mean, Singer wouldn't inflict pain on animals either. The fact that these are human infants is irrelevant to his argument because they're not persons. So if the consequences of killing that infant may be better than the consequences of not killing, in terms of relief of suffering, what's in the best interest of the child, in the best interest of the family, make room for a better baby down the line, one without Down syndrome, then you should not only be, you should have at least 28 days, that's his round figure, although on his criteria, an infant is not a person at 28 days, but you can assess the prospect for those first 4 weeks and not only neglect them, but painlessly euthanize them. Now, I think that that's where, if you take the potential person argument, it virtually removes all protection from the embryo through the infant state. So I think that the idea that these are not actual persons is mistaken. I would say that we ought to answer it something like this, or say something like this, that the fetus is an actual human being who in due course will exhibit the personal characteristics of human nature. The fetus is an actual human being who in due course will exhibit the personal characteristics of human nature. Now, those characteristics as a functioning human being are as yet unrealized because the fetus is still developing. So he's not functioning as a self-conscious, rational, free, moral agent. But that's what he is. I would put it this way, that these characteristics are as yet unrealized because the fetus is still in that developing stage. But here's my point. It is crucial to note that the child does not become a person when they are realized. Rather, these things are realized because he or she is a person. A human being is a person. And given the development, they will exhibit personal characteristics. They don't become a person when they start thinking. They start thinking because they're a personal being. And I think there's a vast difference between a potential person and a person who has not yet reached his or her potential. And I think it's worth recalling the old non-functional definition of a person as an individual subsistence in human nature. Won't fit on a bumper sticker. It's an individual subsistence in human nature, not a choice, you know, but it's the truth. It's the way we ought to look at it. It's an individual subsistence in human nature. That's what a person is. It's a human being is by definition a person. Yes, sir. The child does not become a person when these characteristics are realized. That is, when he starts functioning as a thinking being, relating meaningfully to others. I mean, that takes a while. At least a month. Well, it's early. Rather, they are realized because he or she is a person. In other words, you wouldn't start thinking if you weren't already a person. You don't become a person when you start thinking. You're a developing person that starts thinking. Okay? It's a little okay. I'm saying it doesn't necessarily lead that way, but in principle, it's not different because if you take the definition of a person as rational, reflecting, relating, meaningful to others, an infant isn't any more of a person than the fetus in the womb, if that's your definition. And so consistently, it's a matter of being consistent. We can't say it's a potential person in the womb and not have, and we lose the argument against Peter Singer because he's making the same argument. It's basically the same. You define a person in terms of these functioning characteristics and you remove the protection of Down syndrome babies as well. Yes. Well, I think you're right. We'll get to that next time. I mean, you know, it's a slippery slope. And as a matter of fact, Peter Singer does argue that way. So you're speaking to the point. My fourth point is legality of abortion. Before we get to that, there is something I want to say by way of conclusion on morality of abortion. I'm taking the view that the life of the fetus is to be preserved just as the life of any human being. You can't find a point that will enable you to make an arbitrary distinction between this. We make the exceptive clause for the life of the mother when the life of the fetus and the life of the mother are in conflict. That's not different from the necessary defense argument in the case of adults. Now, I need to say something about the a Roman Catholic distinction that I think is helpful. Roman Catholics distinguish between direct and indirect abortion, because abortion is a termination of pregnancy that results in the death of the fetus. A direct abortion is one in which the immediate purpose is to destroy the human fetus. That's a direct abortion. And that's what most abortions are. The purpose is to have a dead delivery. The purpose of the procedure is to destroy the human fetus. An indirect abortion is one in which the immediate purpose is to treat the mother, to ratify threatening pathology. That is, some circumstance that is life-threatening. To treat the mother, to ratify life-threatening pathology. Let's put it that way. Such as an ectopic pregnancy. Both are going to die. Under rare cases, ectopic pregnancies have been brought to term, but the prospects are really very limited on that in that regard. Normally, if allowed to proceed, both will die. And so an indirect abortion is one in which the immediate purpose is to treat the mother, to ratify life-threatening pathology, but in which the death of the fetus is an inevitable result. Would have been avoided had it been possible. But it's not always possible. That's when we mean except to save the life of the mother. That is where the mother's life is threatened by the presence of the fetus. There's a direct conflict between life and life. You try to save both, but in the event that you can't save both without taking the life of the one, it is permissible as a matter of necessary defense to take the life of the fetus. Yes. I think that the first two are inconsistent with this view that I'm taking. I think that they are pragmatically. It's not that the Republican Party platform itself includes those, but various Republicans define it that way. I think that the platform itself has always called for sanctity of life from the beginning, or the constitutional amendment that's been proposed is except for the life of the mother. But various high-profile candidates for Republican office sometimes take those other two exceptions to remove off the table these highly emotional debates. They are a mere fraction of the number of abortions. So it's an inconsistent, pragmatic rationale. I was brought up short in the 60s when I first got into this area. You know, I started teaching in 1967. First ethics class, I think, was 68. Had a student in the class ask me, "Mr. Jones, are we going to talk about abortion in this class?" Well, you know, I hadn't had anything in my seminary to talk about abortion, but it was getting to be the cutting-edge issue. And so I began to try to think about that, and I thought that rape would be an exception. Because I thought, here you have an aggression, and I identified the child with the aggressor, and you know, that in the solidarity with the aggressor, you could take the life of fetus that was conceived by rape. And I was expounding this view to a ruling elder down in Carbondale, Illinois. And he said, that's very interesting. He had adopted three children. He turned to his third child and he said, this child was product of a rape. Well, I'd be... You know, sometimes the Lord gets your attention with a 2x4. That was like that for me. How could I say that this child is just the aggressor, part of the aggressor, and deserves it to die? You know, that made me rethink that whole argument. Now, there are, in connection with rape, there are treatments after rape that do not impinge upon human life. So the treatment of rape victims is a separate topic, and I haven't written on that, but I know sources, Roman Catholic sources, that there are ways of avoiding pregnancy immediately after rape. You know, it takes some while for conception to take place. It takes at least 26 to 30 hours for there to be conception. So there, I think that, before that, there's time, even before the sperm begins to penetrate the egg. So there are reasons. It's not the horrific thing that is always available. But in terms of requiring women, as a matter of law, to continue a pregnancy under promptly reported rape, it would have to be promptly reported rape, is something that I can understand why. There would be a hesitancy to include that within in the law. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, it depends on the kinds of treatment that you have, but there are various ones. I'm dependent on the book Healthcare Ethics by Benedict Ashley and Kevin O'Rourke. They are down at St. Louis. Well, Ashley is at Aquinas Institute and O'Rourke is at St. Louis University Health Care Center. But that their healthcare ethics is the best treatment that I have seen of the various things in terms of a strongly pro-life view. Written for Catholic hospitals, that's what's permissible in the Catholic situation. And it's more than what we think of. It's Ashley, A-S-H-L-E-Y, and O'Rourke, Kevin O'Rourke. Benedict Ashley and Kevin O'Rourke. Now, under the legality of abortion, it seems to me that it's not possible to not have some concern for abortion as a matter of public justice or restrictive abortion laws as a matter of public justice. In other words, it seems to me that this is a legitimate area for the state, whose basic role is to protect human life, that the state has an interest in that. If you look at what is the next section of the handout, Legalization of Abortion in the USA, I did all these on both sides of the paper. By the way, with our new copier, they only charge you for one copy for a double side. So that's why you're getting all these double-sided copiers. It really, I'm going to be over my budget in all these handouts, but it won't be as bad as it used to be. If you look under on the second page of this particular on legalization of abortion in the USA, Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, the second item there. The life of every human being begins at conception, a phrase I've adopted. I think that's very well crafted. And unborn children have protectable interests in life, health, and well-being. That was the preamble to the Missouri law, and the Supreme Court allowed that to stand on the record. The law that they had was framed to be to be subordinate to Roe v. Wade, but they were able to make that point. The life of every human being begins at conception. Unborn children have protectable interests in life, health, and well-being. Post-Dispatch a while back had an editorial calling for prenatal health care for these most vulnerable of our citizens. Well, I hopped on that. You know, I thank the Post-Dispatch for acknowledging something that the Supreme Court hasn't, that these are our most vulnerable citizens. And we should be on the side of prenatal health care. You know, let's do it. Let's get behind that. Well, protectable interest means that the state does have an interest. You follow through the 60s, you will find that there was a reform movement within the USA. Even Christians were involved in that, the Christian Medical Society in 1968. The earliest reform legislation was California, Colorado, and North Carolina in 1967, basically following the Model Penal Code. In 1970, this was a watershed event. New York permitted abortion on demand within the first 24 weeks. That passed by one vote, passed the legislature by one vote. I only know that because the New York Times on the 30th anniversary ran a series of pieces on that. But that's how close it was. And then 1973, Roe v. Wade went even beyond the New York law. The New York permitted it up to the first 24 weeks. And this is now the standard that we always refer back to. It is the most open abortion law in the Western world. France is more restrictive on abortion than the United States. We think of France as really liberal. In France, a woman, if she's determined to have an abortion, in the end may have one, but there are various hurdles that force her to face the question of respect for life in the womb. If you want to read about that, there is a book by Mary Ann Glendon, Abortion and Divorce in Western Law. Her specialty is international law, and she compares our abortion and divorce laws with those of other Western countries, and we really... it's abortion and divorce in international law, I think. And, the kinds of things that France has introduced by independent counseling, waiting periods, and so forth... the pro-choice movement here has been adamant about any of those things being adopted. It's just too restrictive, even the least restriction. That's the Declaration of Independence. Well, that's the way the Supreme Court interpreted. If you can see here, the first paragraph, sentence, we need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. Well, truth is, we know when life begins, and they didn't want to say. But they go on to talk about the next line of that second paragraph. States' important and legitimate interest in potential life. You see how the potential argument gets inserted there? And they then they divide it into the trimesters. You should know these because I find that often people don't know. And radio call-in program, even the hosts of programs on KMOX have misstated what the law is. And people are very surprised sometimes to learn that you can have an abortion for any reason up till birth. And so familiarize yourself with those trimesters. Notice also on page 2 of this particular handout, in the same year, there was Doe versus Bolton. This is the health clause. The third trimester, the state can prescribe abortion except where it's necessary for the preservation of the life or health of the mother. This is why we always have this fight over whether to include health in these decisions. Doe versus Bolton, same year, defined health as all factors relevant to the well-being of the patient, meaning the mother. Physical, emotional, familial, woman's age, virtually anything that subjectively is taken to affect her life. Health is so broad, that's the problem. It is so broad that it's virtually anything. And folks know that. And that's why the plea is, just to make this health exception. Why can't you make a health exception? Well, the reason is because it's so broad as to be virtually open-ended. That's the issue. Now, The latest Supreme Court decision is Planned Parenthood versus Casey that reinforced Roe. Notice how they reason. We are satisfied that the immediate question is not the soundness of Roe's resolution of the issue. Supreme Court justices, even the liberal ones who support abortion, don't think Roe was argued right, notably Justice Ginsburg. But the precedential force must be accorded the ruling. For two decades of economic and social developments, people have organized their intimate relationships and made choices that define their views of themselves and their places in society in reliance on the availability of abortion in the event that contraception should fail. Abortion is backup contraceptive measure. It's a backup birth control measure. The Supreme Court says that. The Supreme Court now acknowledges that. That's what abortion is. It's a fail-safe birth control method. And this is now precedent, and you have a whole generation who's grown up with this, and we can't go back on it. That's what they're saying. And then there's the last clause. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning of the universe, and the mystery of human life. Often commented on is one of the most puzzling things that the Supreme Court has said, but it means, you know, it's all subjective in terms of that. So that's where we are. James Hunter, I think, had an insight. People don't want to hear pro-lifers talk. That's his point there, that they're, you know, that people just don't want to hear about it. So we have... You know, it's a difficult thing to talk about, and you get intimidated on this issue. People will make gratuitous remarks about it, you know, to intimidate, and they don't want to hear or think about it. I found in William Lee Miller, in arguing about slavery, a parallel. You can read those couple of paragraphs. That by the way, is another fascinating book. I just couldn't put that book down because it was the period of where they had the gag order in Congress, controlled by the slave states, and they were able to have that majority because of the three-fifths rule in the Constitution. That actually worked against slaves because it allowed the southern states to count three-fifths of them in their representation, although those slaves didn't vote at all. It would have been better for them to not be considered at all. And the hero of that period is John Quincy Adams. In Congress, the real hero are the mostly women groups who circulated petitions. The right to petition is in the Constitution, and they made use of this. The petition was that slavery should be abolished in the city of Washington, D.C., in the capital. They couldn't abolish it in the states where it was already existing because of the Constitution, but at least we don't have to look at people being sold in the capital city. And nobody wanted to hear about that. Nobody wanted to hear about that. But these women, they kept it up, kept the petitions going, and eventually something was done. Now, I want you to read. I have another point on infanticide. I really got two points: infanticide, a brief point, and then another point on biomedical research as it relates to human embryos. Read this thing from the Weekly Standard on Partial Birth Revisited. This will show you how the argument changed from when it was first broached, 1966 and 1996 and 97, how the argument of the pro-choice side changed from those years. They don't use those arguments that they used then, and how the argument has shifted to the present day, where the Nebraska law is said to you can't have that because it would impinge upon abortions that we know are constitutional from Roe v. Wade. It's got some hair-raising stuff in it, but you need to read it. You need to read this, what it is, and how, why this argument has developed the way it is. Best place I know in 2 pages that does that. And then the other thing is the stem cell research that was the hearing yesterday. This is from the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. I'm not going to lecture on that particular point, but you should read that to familiarize yourself with the basic idea and what's going on. Okay, thank you.